This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, we mark the anniversary of the fall of Kabul to the Taliban. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The Taliban's offensive began in May of 2021 and culminated on August 15 when Afghan President Ashraf Ghani capitulated and fled the country later that day. At the same time, the Biden administration had been withdrawing remaining troops from the country in accordance with a controversial U.S. Taliban deal brokered by the Trump administration in February 2020. Without the maximum intelligence and air support of U.S. and coalition forces, the Afghan National Army was unable to withstand the Taliban onslaught as provincial capital after provincial capital fell in succession. The U.S. intelligence community underestimated the speed with which the Taliban would capture Kabul and topple the government. During the last 2 weeks of August 2021, the U.S. and its coalition partners evacuated more than 123,000 people from Kabul in what became the largest non-combatant airlift operation in U.S. military history. It was also a bittersweet end to the longest war in U.S. history. The very group which harbored al-Qaeda, the terror group behind the deadly attack on U.S. soil on September 11, 2001, was now back in power. Notwithstanding tactical and strategic errors by successive U.S. administrations in Afghanistan, U.S. development aid and technical assistance fostered democratic values and meaningful progress for women and girls, which has now been abruptly reversed since the Taliban's return to Kabul. Given their ultra-conservative interpretation of Islam, few expected that the Taliban would perpetuate women's rights, but that the insurgent group would harbor top al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri in contravention of the Doha agreement was a bridge too far. Despite no boots on the ground, the U.S. intelligence community conducted a rare counterterrorism strike on July 31st, which eliminated al-Zawahiri, who was living in a residential compound in Kabul under the protection of the Taliban. VOA's Ayaz Ghul quotes a State Department official, quote, "By hosting and sheltering the leader of al-Qaeda in Kabul, the Taliban grossly violated the Doha agreement and repeated assurances to the world that they would not allow Afghan territory to be used by terrorists to threaten the security of other countries." Unquote. Ghul goes on to report that Zawahiri's presence in the heart of Kabul is seen as a humiliating blow to the Taliban, who seized power nearly a year ago and have been seeking international legitimacy for their rule. Well, for more on the state of play in Afghanistan, as we mark the dark anniversary of the Taliban takeover, we turn to two distinguished regional experts. Michael Kugelman is Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center, and that's a policy group based here in Washington, and Elizabeth Threlkeld. She's a Senior Fellow and Director of the South Asia Program at the Stimson Center, a think tank also based in Washington. And both guests join me via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Thanks for having us.
Michael Kugelman, let me begin with you briefly. We're here 1 year on. Give us a sense of where we stand today in Afghanistan with regard to the Taliban takeover.
Thanks, Carol. It's clearly been an extremely difficult year for Afghanistan, for the Afghan people who are arguably experiencing the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, even with the war in Ukraine. There's still many indications that the humanitarian situation in Afghanistan doesn't have any equals anywhere. And there's also been a broader economic crisis that really has not been eased all that much, in great part because Afghanistan for so many years had been dependent, heavily dependent on international assistance. And yet when the Taliban took over, the Taliban is a sanctioned entity, and that meant that once it took over, all of this international financial assistance that had come to Afghanistan for so long, so much of that is not coming anymore. So it's just been an incredibly difficult year for Afghans. There also has been the persistent threat of terrorism. Islamic State Khorasan is a group that has been present in Afghanistan for quite some years, but it really intensified its attacks after the Taliban takeover, its arrival of the Taliban. So it sought to make the Taliban look bad, and it's carried out dozens of attacks. Many of them, if not most of them, have actually targeted the Taliban, though many of them have targeted civilians as well. It's also been a difficult year for the Taliban, quite frankly. It struggled to ease these incredibly complex policy crises. There's indications that the group has seen divisions within the ranks that could well intensify. But at the end of the day, I think it's quite striking that 1 year later, despite the problems that the Taliban have faced with divisions, with failing to deal with these terrible crises, struggling to gain legitimacy from within Afghanistan, they're still in a great place. And in the immediate term, their power is not under any threat in the sense that August 15th, 2021, when they took Kabul, at that point, they controlled nearly 100% of the entire country. That's still the same now. There's no real viable opposition to the Taliban at this point. There is some resistance in the Panjshir region, but it's very modest, and the Taliban has been able to brutally suppress that. So 1 year later, it may be struggling, the Taliban, but it is, at this point at least, still very much in control.
Turning to you, Elizabeth Threlkeld, for your take on the situation today in Afghanistan with the Taliban still struggling, but as Michael Kugelman says, in control without any real viable opposition.
I largely agree with Michael's assessment, and I think it's striking to the extent that, you know, reflecting 1 year on, it was difficult to imagine how the situation in Afghanistan would have unfolded. Michael referenced the internal divisions and tensions within the Taliban, which really has been their main priority in some ways. This is an insurgent group that was much more comfortable for multiple decades waging an insurgent battle. And we've seen the Taliban sometimes struggling to make the transition from that role of an insurgent group to now being the effective government of Afghanistan, regardless of the status of recognition in the international community, which has not been forthcoming to date. And that is one of the key tensions that I think has been notable over the past year, is the extent to which the Taliban itself has prioritized its own stability and trying to forestall, for example, the development of spoiler factions or disabused fighters going over, for example, to join ISK, the Islamic State Khorasan group. And because of that, I think it's been particularly challenging for the international community, both within the region and the U.S. and beyond, to try to find ways to shape incentives for the Taliban and to negotiate changes in their behavior, simply because they are so focused on those internal dynamics and maintaining their own internal coherence and stability. And I think looking back over the year, that really has been what I would peg as the key dynamic that's played out. And it remains an open question in my mind, the extent to which they have consolidated their role in government. Certainly, they maintain control over the vast majority of the country. And as Michael said, there isn't a viable opposition. But I think it's still quite difficult to read from the outside the extent to which there is more of a growing sense of confidence within the group in terms of their own stability that could perhaps create a bit more space for international engagement.
Turning back to you, Michael Kugelman, as the Taliban prioritizes its own stability, as Elizabeth said, that means that it's to the detriment of the vast majority of the population. And as you said, there's a huge humanitarian crisis. People are starving. What are the sources of income that the Taliban can rely on with regard to economic support? What is the status of recognition by the international community? I assume some countries are dealing with the Taliban. Give us a sense of that. But I assume that the fact that the Taliban had harbored the number one al-Qaeda figure, Ayman al-Zawahiri, that doesn't endear them much to the West and would not encourage the West to change their perspective anytime soon.
Right. So not to give too much credit to the Taliban, I wouldn't want to come across as doing that. But I think it is important to acknowledge that over the last year, we have seen the group be in a position to come out with some degree of an economic strategy, in the sense that at one point, some months ago, the Taliban released a budget. They also have been able to ensure that border trade continues in many contexts, and they've been able to generate revenues from customs tariffs and other border taxes that go along with that trade. So that's the key source of revenue. Also, corruption. The indications that corruption is not as widespread within the ranks now as it had been when pre-Taliban governments were in power. Now, I think one big reason for that is not that the Taliban have become champions of anti-corruption, but more so that you simply don't have all this money coming into the country from overseas as it had happened before. And because you haven't had as much money coming into the country, that means there's less likely that there'd be corruption, just because the more money coming in, the more opportunities there are for money to be siphoned off and so on. But yes, in terms of legitimacy and recognition, the Taliban have struggled to get legitimacy both at home and abroad. And sometimes over the last year, it appeared that the Taliban were more keen to focus on appeasing their own rank and file and members. And I think this gets to the important points that Elizabeth was making about how the Taliban have prioritized trying to maximize the chances of cohesion and stability within. You know, one of the more memorable public events that the Taliban had over the last year was this big ceremony, I think at one of the luxury hotels in Kabul, in which families of Taliban suicide bombers were invited. And there was this big ceremony to honor the suicide bombers that had been killed. What does that do for the broader population who's on the verge of starvation? It doesn't do much, but it certainly may help things within the Taliban. There was also a major military parade that the Taliban held in which they showcased all this weaponry that had been left behind by the United States and the NATO forces. Again, what does that do to benefit common Afghans? What does it do to endear the Taliban to the broader Afghan population? Not much, but those are the types of things the Taliban emphasized. Externally, just the fact that not one country has recognized the Taliban regime is an indication of how the Taliban have failed on that front. But I think this also could perhaps get to the divisions with the group, that I think it would be inaccurate to suggest that for the U.S. and other key donors to dangle the possibility of stepped up financial assistance and recognition if the Taliban were to show more respect for human rights, to crack down more on terrorism. If that were to be done, not that the Taliban would actually change in those ways, but my sense is that those in high places in the Taliban are much less concerned about changing their fundamental principles and ideologies for the sake of being in a position to get more international assistance. They're much less concerned about that than they are about, again, making sure that those at the top are happy. And you know, I think at this point, whereas you have a Taliban government in Kabul, the mullahs, religious figures that head this Shura, leadership council based in Kandahar, they're really calling the shots. That's where the supreme leader of the Taliban is. And I don't think those folks are that interested in suddenly showing more respect for women or showing more respect for human rights. So it really is a troubling state of affairs. At the end of the day, the Taliban have struggled to get legitimacy both inside and outside. And that clearly is a mark against the group.
Elizabeth Threlkeld, not one country has recognized the Taliban, as Michael said. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. And it's quite remarkable. To be honest, it's not the outcome that I would have anticipated this time last year. I was concerned that the broader dynamics of great power competition, the U.S.-China rivalry that we're seeing play out right now around the world, would come home to roost in many ways in Afghanistan. And that by this point, I might have anticipated countries like Pakistan and China, potentially Russia as well, Iran, maybe a question mark, having recognized the Taliban and worked out or attempted to work out some sort of security guarantees, as each of those countries has groups that are based in Afghanistan that they find particularly troubling or worrisome. So the idea of using recognition as leverage as sorts in order to try to incentivize the Taliban to prioritize groups that are threatening their own security, that hasn't happened. And I think that's pretty remarkable and speaks to the extent to which there does seem to be a quite rare bit of international agreement on the challenges that the Taliban represents as a regime, both in terms of inclusivity, rights, but also on the security front. This question that I was referring to earlier of how best to influence their behavior. No one seems to want to go first. And I think once that wall breaks, which ultimately it will in some form, I don't know when, I think there will be a number of countries that could adopt some sort of recognition, but that hasn't happened yet. And so I think that does give the international community more of a united voice than I might have anticipated this time last year. To Michael's excellent point, the extent to which that matters and is able to influence and shape the Taliban's behavior, I think, is very much questionable, and increasingly so, particularly with the the leadership of the group based in Kandahar. What I will say, though, is even though no country has formally recognized the Taliban, a number of countries are being very creative with de facto associations with the group. So a handful of countries have exchanged ambassadors or at least have diplomats working to kind of do the necessary functions of diplomacy, things like visas, for example. Even India, which was perhaps one of the countries that was the most troubled by the transition and the Taliban's return to power, given its own security interests and its deep investments in the Islamic Republic, even India now has returned a technical team to Kabul. And they're predominantly focused on humanitarian assistance, for example. But that, to my mind, is really significant and speaks to kind of this pragmatic approach that seems to be developing, where everyone is trying to toe the line, staying behind formal recognition. But there's a lot of work being done kind of behind the scenes at the de facto level right now.
You are listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center, and Elizabeth Threlkeld, from whom you just heard. She's Senior Fellow and Director of the South Asia Program at the Stimson Center. We're taking stock of the situation in Afghanistan on the anniversary of the fall of Kabul to the Taliban. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Well, here's a shout out to Naqib Hejran from Paktia province in Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our discussion. Turning back to you, Michael Kugelman, with regard to Pakistan, of course, initially they were rather happy about the Taliban takeover, but 1 year later, enthusiasm for the Taliban rule has seem to wane among most Pakistanis. How would you characterize the relations between Islamabad and Kabul today?
Right, indeed. When the Taliban took over, whereas Pakistan's government would not have stated this publicly, I certainly think that they were optimistic that things could improve for their prospects, for their interests in Afghanistan, in that an entity that had been on their side, so to speak, for the duration of the war was now going to lead the country. And for many years, Pakistan's core interest in Afghanistan has been having a government there that is friendly to Pakistan, because that would suggest that a government friendly to Pakistan would be unfriendly to India, Pakistan's rival. And we'd seen over the 20 years of the war that India had a very good relationship with the Afghan governments in place. India was a top supplier of humanitarian assistance. It was involved in a number of major development projects in Afghanistan. And that had helped India also develop a fair amount of goodwill with the Afghan population. Whereas for many in Afghanistan, Pakistan had been mistrusted because of its known ties to the Taliban, which, of course, was doing all these terrible things in Afghanistan for so many years. So I think that indeed for Pakistan, there was hope that things would change. But clearly, if that was the case, that did not anticipate the complications that would come into play once the Taliban took over. And I think one of the big manifestations of the problems between Pakistan and the Taliban regime was on the border. And I know this is something Elizabeth has focused on a lot. She may want to weigh in as well. But it's quite striking that pretty soon after the Taliban took over, there were actually some clashes between Taliban fighters and Pakistani soldiers. Pakistani soldiers were doing what they had been doing for several years, and that was fencing off the border. That was a problem for the Taliban because the Taliban, like most governments that have been in Afghanistan since Pakistan's formation, have opposed that border. They don't recognize it as a legitimate border. It's known as the Durand Line. So that may have been a bit of a shock to the system for Pakistan. But the second big tension point between the two was the issue of terrorism. Pakistan, I think, had thought that the Taliban would be willing to help Pakistan deal with the problem of the Pakistani Taliban, which is separate from the Taliban in Afghanistan, a group that for many years had staged campaigns of horrific violence in Pakistan. Pakistan had staged a counterterrorism offensive some years ago that degraded that threat in Pakistan, but also pushed much of the Pakistani Taliban leadership into Afghanistan. Pakistan had hoped that the Taliban would try to curb the presence of that Pakistani Taliban in Afghanistan. didn't work out that way. Not surprising to many of us, but the Taliban in Afghanistan has been very close and allied with the Pakistani Taliban. So what happened instead is there is talks that took place between the Pakistani states and the Pakistani Taliban, mediated by members of the Taliban in Afghanistan. Those haven't been very successful. So as a result, Pakistan has looked at a situation where it's facing a resurgence of terrorist attacks in Pakistan by a group that is based in Afghanistan and is not being curbed by the Taliban. And I think this is one reason why Pakistan, unlike what many thought, has not been willing to recognize the Taliban. Until it sees that its own security concerns are being addressed in Afghanistan, I don't think it's going to recognize the Taliban regime. And clearly the Taliban in Afghanistan has not been willing to play ball in the ways that Islamabad would like it to.
Well, turning to you, Elizabeth Threlkeld, let's close with the drone strike the United States conducted on Ayman al-Zawahiri, who had been sheltered in Afghanistan under the Taliban, which would indicate that they are in violation of the Doha Agreement, which said that they would not shelter and coordinate with terrorist groups. So your take on that particular operation and what it says about the Taliban's coordinating with terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda that have in the past threatened the security of the U.S. homeland. What does this say about the Taliban and also divisions within the ranks? Because presumably he was being sheltered under the so-called Haqqani network, and that also has a relationship to Pakistan. And if the Taliban faces more challenges in the second year, to what extent is that an incentive for them to rein in this Haqqani network, which has harbored al-Zawahiri? What is the relationship between the Haqqani network within the Taliban and the other members of the Taliban? Give us a sense of where things stand and what the implications are.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, at this point, this is the conversation that has been playing out of trying to assess where the Haqqani network fits in. But what we've seen over the past year is the Haqqani network is in the leadership of the Taliban, right? So the Interior Ministry, other ministries playing a very influential role. And in fact, the Haqqani network has been one of the factions of the Taliban that has engaged with representatives from the outside, with the UN, other states as well. And so I think attempts to contain the Haqqani network and its influence within the broader Taliban, I mean, that ship has sailed. So that leaves us in a really challenging position where this group is clearly found to have been harboring Al-Qaeda's top leader. Where do we go from here? And I think that will be a real challenge for the Taliban to handle and message internally. We've already seen a very uncomfortable statement from the Taliban claiming no knowledge of anything that had happened while not being terribly clear about what that thing was that had happened. So this is going to be potentially a trigger for a very challenging time that the Taliban will face. Looking ahead as well over the course of next year, it's going to make decisions that the U.S. and international community faces increasingly difficult too. So even though we are here in August, I think it's always important to keep in mind that winter is just around the corner in terms of the impacts on the Afghan people. And we've already seen just incredibly troubling images and reports in terms of the level of food insecurity within the country. And as winter approaches, I am concerned about the ability of Afghanistan's population to withstand yet more time without access to sufficient food, not to mention livelihood support, as Afghanistan's economy remains largely stalled. And Michael mentioned at the opening the role that the U.S. and international community play in those calculations. And as we see potential moves towards trying to alleviate some of the economic distress in Afghanistan, finding ways to attempt to reinvest in Afghanistan's economy beyond the strictest confines of humanitarian aid, those conversations get a lot more challenging and sensitive in the aftermath of the Zawahiri strike. So I think concerning times ahead, particularly looking at how Afghanistan's population is likely to fare in the year ahead. And I hope we can keep that top of mind beyond just the 1 year anniversary of the takeover.
Well, on that dubious note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director of the Asia Program at the Wilson Center, and Elizabeth Threlkeld, Senior Fellow and Director of the South Asia Program at the Stimson Center. Thank you both for your terrific insights. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.